Didn't take much to entertain you guys. So we're going to pick up today in Genesis. We're going to actually do chapter 11, but I do want to come back a little bit to chapter 10 before we start, because I want to do some things which I think, at least for me and hopefully for you, it kind of ties together some of the things we talked about last week in terms of the countries, the nations, and where who they were and who they'll be. So seems like every time they update this thing, they move all the controls around where I can't find them. So let me update the Middle East for you right now. Not a lot's going on with the hostages situation. There's some negotiations going on. The U.S. is directly involved, and Israel has come back to the table. The problem is, of course, that Egypt and the UAE, or Qatar, I forget who it is, who is brokering some of these talks, have also been very complicit in the whole support of Hamas. So the talks, I think some of these things are really getting brought to light. But a couple of things are happening that are much different. Remember, we talked about Syria and how the Assad regimes fell and there was a big chaos. Well, the group that took over have tried to put on a suit and look like they want to be members of the world community. But what's happening is the Alawites, who are the sect of Muslims that Bashar al-Assad came from, they're going and they're murdering them by the thousands, just lining them up and killing them, men, women, children, all of them. They're also killing Christians. They're killing Orthodox priests, who have been there for a long time. If you don't know, Syria and Lebanon both are long time Christian enclaves. A lot of Christians there, not very many now, but there were millions of them years ago. And what's happening is, if somebody gets hurt in Israel or if a Jew gets stabbed, it's all over the news. Nobody's covering these thousands and thousands of people. If you want to see them, you'll have to go to the Jerusalem Post probably and take a look, because it's really the same old thing. But you can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig at the end of the day. And these terrorists are still terrorists. They haven't changed their stripes, so that's who they are. There's also some resurgence going on in Lebanon and in Gaza. In fact, Gaza tried to set up and shoot a rocket at Israel yesterday, I believe. The rocket misfired and landed in Gaza, so it didn't cause any problems. But it just kind of gives you an idea of the mentality of these people. So phase two of the hostage negotiation is not going anywhere right now. Israel wants to continue phase one. Hamas wants to go to phase two because that gets Israel out and it leaves them in charge. And I don't think that's going to happen. So we've got a kind of big standoff going on there. Of course, not very far away. Ukraine and Russia are still in, still battling. And even though peace may look like it's on the horizon, there's still a lot going on there. Rockets flying, all kinds of stuff, killing civilians every single day. That is a, it just seems like nobody wants peace. They all want to continue the war. And so we'll see how that turns out. There's a lot of things going on in the US. You can read about them in the paper and the DOGE reports and all that's happening. Fraud and waste is continuing. Tariff war with Mexico and Canada, we've been reading about that. I think we've eased off a little bit with Mexico because Mexico has stepped up pretty well to try to block the drugs. Canada's dragging their feet. And so, we're going to get a little bit of peacock strutting around that for a while until somebody figures out, what they're going to do. So,
That's the way the French are.
yeah. They're not negotiating with Quebec, though. Yeah. Oh, that wouldn't surprise me a whole lot. Canada imports fewer percentage of drugs into the U.S. than Mexico does, but they have done less to try to restrict them also. So I think that's part of the deal. Anyway, that's kind of what's going on there. Any questions about Israel or Ukraine or anything like that? Yeah, John.
Well, I don't understand how anybody can threaten when they've got the hostages.
Yeah, that's going to be a pretty delicate situation, I think, because all the hostages left, I believe, are IDF hostages, and then of course the dead ones. And I wouldn't surprise me anytime that Israel just goes in wholesale and goes after them. And if they lose another 15 soldiers, then they may lose them, because they have shown pictures of life and they look like skeletons. They're starving them to death. So I don't know what's going to happen there. I don't know how long it's going to be, in place, but I think that's kind of where we are right now. And I don't know how they can go in either without getting the hostages all killed. But we'll see. I guess time will give us a little bit of a clue. The other thing, of course, is the whole Judea and Samaria rising up to come against Israel. And Israel has done quite a bit to destroy the two big centers of jihadi work over there. One is in Jenin, and I forget the name of the other one, but they've gone in and cleared a bunch of things out and, blown up storage places that are making bombs. So they're making progress there, but, that's going to be a forever situation unless they decide to actually, get rid of all of them. But again, we'll see how that goes. Yeah. Azerbaijan, Vicky's favorite little country. Yeah, Don's talking about a country called Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan is a Muslim country, but they're not a warring country, and they're friendly with Israel. Israel has had the ability to stop and fuel planes there before. So it's kind of interesting to see how that's all going to work out. I don't know what it is, but many people think there's a little place for Azerbaijan in the end times struggle. I know. Somebody sitting over there on that end thinks that. Yeah, Bob.
Europe.
Yep.
Germany is
And Sweden. Yeah, there's Bob's making the point about the Muslim population increases in Europe. Sweden is probably in very bad shape, because they've got so many of them, and they're not a warlike country, but they've been taken over essentially. And I'm sure, Denmark and all of them are not far behind. But France, we see France a lot in Germany. They're the two big ones that are. Yeah, in Germany, and they're having some trouble. So we'll see what's happening. The other thing I would say about those two countries, in particular, is there's some what you might call America first people that are, Germany first, France first, who are not into the globalism, that are trying to rise on the political stage. So you may see some of that kind of what's happened here in America go through Europe, and if it does, that will increase the tension there. But hopefully, it'll stop it from getting worse
The only
than it
thing
is
that
now.
is Germany a lot of people.
Yeah. Not enough, though. Not enough. Well, I appreciate that. Okay, no other questions on that front. Let's move on. So we left last time when we studied the book of Genesis chapter 10, and I put this map up to really give you a little bit more of a understanding of some of these countries. Shem is the Semite branch of Noah's son. So the Arabs and the Jews come out of this branch. Ham is the African branch. So, Egypt, Lebanon, Canaan, all that come out of this region. And then Japheth really is mostly the European and Near East regions. And this is kind of held true all the way. And I want to take you just on a little bit of a quick journey into prophecy. I know some of you like prophecy, some of you don't, but let me just give you the names of the nations. So when you read in the ancient text, the names Rosh or Rashu or Respu or Ross or Rus, depending on your translation, that's all Russia today. Magog or Magog are who you would call the Scythians, and they are all of the stands, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, all of those. I'll show you where they are on a map. Meshech is Turkey. Tubal is also Turkey, although it kind of bleeds around Turkey a little bit. Persia is Iran, but in that day, Persia was also part of Afghanistan and Pakistan. So that area was much bigger. But so when the Bible talks about Persia, it's not just Iran. It's Iran and these surrounding countries. Put, or P-H-U-T, Put, however you say that, is the modern country of Libya. It's also called Libya in some places. Gomer, they're a group of people called the Sumerians, and they are in Turkey also. Sheba, Dedan, and Tarshish. Sheba and Dedan are two countries that are down on the Arabian Peninsula. And, if you read the Bible, you see the Queen of Sheba and all this stuff down around the area, around southern part of Saudi Arabia today. And then Tarshish, many people believe is Spain. And we'll talk about the Tarshish. And the Tarshish is where the Sephardic Jews come from that came back into Israel. And there was a big stink up there, if you remember, when the Muslims moved up there, called the Moors, what were they called? Yeah. So the Moor, the Moorish influence in Spain was all Arabian. And so there was some battles up there at that time. Kind of interesting. I will say, just as a little sideline, Christopher Columbus, many people think Christopher Columbus was not Italian at all, but was Jewish. And that he was sent by England, sent by Spain to the New World for Spain, but he went to find a place for the Jews because that was the very time of the Inquisition, and Jews were being killed all over Spain and France
again.
And nobody knows that, except there's some documentation on the ship that they recovered, the leftover, that indicates he had a fascination with the Jewish people. So whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it does kind of lend an interesting twist to what we understand as history. Was it really a place to find a place for the Jews to flee? It is an interesting side note that the two countries in the world that house the most Jews are Israel and the United States, both with about 8 million. Some days we're higher, some days they're higher, but about 8 million. The rest of the world had a lot, but they're all diminished now because of all the people going back to Israel or being killed off in the country. Yeah, Joe. They did, and he could have been, and he could have been a closet Jew masquerading as a Catholic to stay alive, in Italy. So you just don't know about that. But I bring that up only to say, we have this version of history that we studied in school, Western civilization or whatever. But the details are far messier than that when you get into them. And there's a lot of little things that make a difference. Mizrau is one of the early names for Egypt. You'll see that some places. And then Beth Togarma is Turkey also. So a lot of this is Turkey and the little surrounding lands. So that's the table of nations, if you will, old to new. So let me move to the next slide. In Ezekiel, this is my little venture into prophecy. In Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39 is the story of the war we call Gog and Magog. This is the story that comes after Ezekiel 37, where it's called the Valley of Dry Bones. You've never studied Ezekiel. It's a worthwhile study. Valley of Dry Bones is the prediction that Israel will come back as a nation. And we see that happen in 1948. So a lot of these predictions, while Ezekiel had no idea when they were going to happen, these were things that he prophesied would happen for the Jews. So in chapter 38, he moves from restoring the Jewish nation to a war against the Jewish nation, which hasn't happened yet. So, son of man, set your face against Gog. Gog is many times called the prince of Rosh. So this is a person, Gog, of the land of Magog. Again, we talked about that's that area north of the Black Sea where all the stands are, you know, Uzbekistan, whatever they are. The chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. Again, these are areas up in that region. Meshach is also translated into Moscow. There's some other ways that they get that north of the Black Sea. Tubal is the area, kind of Romania and all that other area over there. And say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against you, Gog, chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. I'll turn you around, put hooks in your jaws, and bring you out with your whole army, your horses, your horsemen fully armed, great horde with large and small shields, all of them branding their swords. Persia, Cush, and Put will be with them, all with shields and helmets, and also Gomer with all of its troops, Beth Togarma from the far north with all of its troops, and many nations with you. This has always been kind of an enigma of a prophecy, and it really speaks about what happens to Israel after they become a nation. And most people just dismiss these prophecies until 1948 because nobody ever thought Israel would be able to come back. But once Israel came back, a great interest began to come in these prophecies that took place after that. And this is one of them. And I'm not trying to give you a prophecy lesson here, but I do want to just tell you that these table of nations are really important to understand prophecies later in the Bible. So this is a map of nations. And you can see, of course, Israel's this little tiny green thing right here. And you can see Turkey and Magog and Persia and Cush. Cush is Sudan and Ethiopia now. Put is Libya and Tunisia and a couple of other countries over here. Meshach is this general area right in here, you know, down. So this is Ukraine. So you got Ukraine, Moldova, Poland, Belarus, you know, even Austria back in this area. So this is all Meshach. Rosh is this big area that goes far to the east, which is Russia. So China and India, most people think these were populated by some of these tribes that moved over this way. But from this map perspective, I'm just showing you the countries that are there today. This, by the way, is a chart out of one of the presentations I have on my website. So if you ever want to learn how to do that, I'll probably take a lesson sometime and teach you how to do that. Yeah, it is. And the one thing I want to say about Ezekiel, I don't think I have another chart on verses. I don't. Let me go back. Ezekiel not only talks about the war of Gog and Magog, but he also talks about how the war ends. All of these people meet to come against Israel in what's called the Plain of Jezreel, which is if you go to Israel and you go to Megiddo, And Megiddo is a 50 generation town up in northern Galilee. And Megiddo used to be a place where armies would gather out in that field. And we've got pictures of us standing there. A number of you, if you've been to Israel, have probably stood there. Well, it's a great flat field with mountains on each side, and it leads right down into the heart of Israel. And so that's where they will come and make their stand and come against Israel on the mountains of Israel. Well, what Ezekiel says is when they get there and get into the mountains to get ready to come against Israel, they will shake the mountains, open holes, hailstones, rain, brimstone, everything will fall on them, and the Lord will effectively make them go into chaos. And the ones that don't die will start killing each other, but they really don't like each other. They just like Israel less. And so it's kind of an interesting thing. God has a way with little Israel of just taking care of it himself. And that's one of the interesting things about the war of Gog and Magog. So Ezekiel's called an action prophet. If you ever read the book, most prophets just tell you what's going to happen. Ezekiel acts it out. So he, builds little sets and models. And if you read it, it's really kind of fascinating. Wendell Jackson did a series on it 4 or 5 months ago. I've got something on my website too if you want to listen to it. It's not in the time when I was doing the video, so it's just audio and slides, but you'll be able to pick it out. So that's an important book. And I just bring up this table of nations because before we leave this table of nations, understand that it's not just something Old Testament that's dusty and stays there. It's something that moves in the prophetic word as we get closer and closer to the end time. Somewhere in here. Ezekiel is a good study. I've done it before. I can do it again. It's a great study. So let me just tell you about Ezekiel. If you look at Ezekiel, you can see Ezekiel was at Chebar. You remember Chebar? Chebar is one of the little rivers that runs past Babylon. So he was one of the captives. And this goes through all of some of the really weird visions that he has. And then we come down here, and this is the time frame. So Ezekiel sees the resurrection of the dry bones. That's when Israel comes back. He sees the future wars in 38, and he sees God's judgment in 39. And then he sees the second temple vision as well. So again, Ezekiel is a really kind of a, like Daniel, it's one of the pivotal Old Testament books that sets the stage for the next 2,000 years. And so we may do that. I'll take a look at it. See if I want to do it again. Again, here's the countries that come against Israel, just to give you a map of where they come from. Dedan and Sheba are down here. So they come from Ethiopia, Cush, which is Ethiopia, and Sudan now. They come from this area over by Lebanon and all that. And then they come out of all of this area of Europe up north of the Black Sea and from Iran. So you get a pretty good idea. Now, the thing you don't see here is the inner circle of people right around Israel do not participate in this. So Saudi Arabia doesn't participate, Lebanon doesn't participate. And so it's kind of fascinating who is in and who is out of this war. It may give you a little clue as to where peace treaties may end up, in the future. I don't know. It's all speculative. And I want to tell you, just kind of point to where this is. I really took a while to try to find a better chart than this one, but this is a very simplified chart. So we are right now in what's called the church age. And that's the time after the coming of the Holy Spirit back in, in Jesus's time, or right after Jesus's time. And that church age goes until something we call the rapture of the church. At the rapture of the church, Christians are taken out, and there are no Christians on the other side of this line, right in this area. And this is when most people theorize the War of Gog and Magog may happen, because we don't really know. It could happen on this side also, but it's right around the time of the rapture of the church. And it's just kind of interesting as we look at all the signs for the tribulation. There are no signs for the rapture. And you look at all the things with Gog and Magog going on in the world today, it looks like they're kind of coming together. Now, you know, whether that's today, tomorrow, 10 years from now, I don't know. But that's just kind of where it positions. And of course, then you have the 7-year tribulation, the last week, the 70th week of Daniel, desecration of the temple, all that. And then you have Christ who comes back to earth with the church this time. This, he takes the church with him. Then he comes back with the church. And we have the 1,000-year millennial reign and then the eternal state. So this is kind of a timeline. And I wanted to just show you that the possible Gog and Magog war is right around this period. Some people think it's here later, but there's a couple of things that says it's going to take Israel 7 years to clean up all the mess after the war, after God kills them all. And if that's the case, then they need that full 7 years to do it. Yeah, Julie. Yes. Yes. Right. That's back. That's over here on this eternal state side. But yes. And most people think that the redeemed church who is back can move between heaven and earth during the millennial period. But we're here along with all those that have been saved during the tribulation time. And so, you know, there are some people who are saved who aren't killed in the tribulation, and they cross over as humans into the millennial period. So there's humans, there's immortals, and of course then there's, you know, God and all of the angelic host are all there at that time. And of course, I'll just add this, the humans that come across are the ones that bear children during that 1,000 years. And that's why at the end of the period, they have to either come to the Lord or be judged, because they've never made a judgment for Christ. So, it's kind of messy if you get into it. You could spend an hour really on any section of this and talk about it. But my point is really just to show you where this is in the schedule. I want to now step back from prophecy and get back to Genesis. Genesis 11 talks about the Tower of Babel. And let's read it, and then we'll talk a little bit about what it means. So now the whole world had one language and a common speech. So remember in chapter 10, it was kind of a panorama of all of the children of the three sons of Noah. Now it steps back and begins to talk about some things within that period of time. This one is about the time of Nimrod. Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As the people moved eastward, so as they moved from Mesopotamia eastward, they found the area called Chaldea or Shinar, and that's where they set up their settlement. They found the plain of Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Really, it's not really tar, it's really asphalt. So they used, you know, remember they coated the inside of the ark with pitch or with asphalt. Well, that was common apparently there everywhere because there's oil everywhere. And so they baked bricks and then used this asphalt as the mortar to stack them up. And then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we'll be scattered over the face of the whole earth." So this is only two sentences, but we get a couple of things out of this. One is, remember their first command from the Lord once they came out of the ark. The first command was to, multiply and, you know, and take and move out into the land. And of course, you know, they did that. There were probably millions of people. I don't know how many there were at the time, but there was a lot of people. And some of them decided they didn't want to move out into the country. They wanted to stay in the city. And so they decided not to obey the Lord, but to build a big city. Now, this is the city of Babylon, at least what started as the city of Babylon. And so they built this city, and then they decided that since they defied God, they would build a tower that reached all the way to heaven. And they would become very important people in all of the new generations of people. So we'll make a name for ourselves. And why are they doing it? Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth. They didn't want to leave. They wanted to stay together. So we see here kind of a defiance of God's commands. He didn't ask a whole lot of them, but he did ask them to multiply and to move and fill the earth, and they didn't want to do that. They also asked him to obey him, and they didn't want to do that either. Always good connecting word. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower. The word tower here is the word Migdal. We talked about that before. Tower of the flock, Migdal, Adar. So the Lord came down to inspect what they were doing, see what they were doing. And the Lord said, if as one people speak in the same language, they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. It is kind of interesting that the Lord uses an if-then clause for you English teachers. If they do this, then I'm doing this. And that's kind of, you know, it's kind of a pronouncement and a judgment to follow. And he says, then, so if they, because they're speaking the languages one another, they're able to communicate, they're able to marshal large forces of people to do whatever they want to do, and nothing will be impossible for them. So then the Lord says, come, let us go down. Again, this is a plural term for God here, Elohim. Let us go down and confuse their language so that they will not understand each other. So the Lord scattered them from there all over the earth, and they stopped building the city. Now, a little parenthetical term here in verse 9. That is why it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the world. Babel is a Hebrew sounding word that means confusion or confused. So they came down to confuse the language. And we, you know, today we, if somebody's saying something to us and we don't understand them, what do we say? They're babbling to us. I mean, they may be babbling and they may be speaking some other language. I don't know. But Babel is kind of a term that we've all used. And there's a language program now called Babel, which you can go learn a different language. Kind of interesting play on words there. John, did you have? I would assume that's true. We're not told that, but they do go off and form these separate countries that all speak the same language. So I think we can infer that that's true. You know, so just picture now, they're all in Babylon. And one day they can all talk to each other, and the next day they don't understand each other. They can't talk to one another. And, you know, we see signs today. We will read, if you, you know, read some of these weird things on the internet, where somebody had an operation and they came out of the anesthetic and now they speak fluent German, you know, never spoke German in their life or whatever language, you know. And so, you know, God must have a way of basically flipping the English, German, Swiss, whatever language inside of us so that we speak whatever language, you know, he desires for us to speak. But the net of it is he confused their language. They couldn't build the city anymore. So they each in their own language scattered to the lands that were all around them. And that's kind of interesting. The other thing I'll say is the Lord confused their language, and that caused them to be scattered. So the Lord scattered them as well.
When we read this, to me, it seems like God went down and poof, it happened overnight. I'm really thinking, though, that it took a while, and I can just imagine the confusion that the folks had
you know, they go to their cousin or their uncle or whatever, and they can't understand each other. And what were they thinking? I mean, they didn't think that, well, God did this, we better go scatter. Like,
yeah, we disobeyed him, and this is his punishment. I'm sure that was not the case. I don't know how fast it happened. I sort of think it happened like that, you know, but it's you can't tell from this, John.
When you have languages that are totally unrelated, without the same root.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you look at the Cyrillic, and you look at Italian or French or Spanish, they're totally different from one another. You know, the Romance languages are very similar. And then English is kind of a mix of a couple of other, you know, German and a couple of others. Yeah, it is interesting. Although linguists will trace words like mother that are common words across languages, and they can see roots of languages from looking at specific words and concepts. It's kind of interesting, but that's a study in and of itself to understand the languages and where they came from and how they originated and how they moved, you know, from one country to another one. So that's kind of the shorthand version of Babylon. Now we come to Genesis, where we revert back to an ancestry look. And remember before we had this little pattern that was used in all of these, where it says the father had the son at this age, and then the father lived this many more years, had other sons and daughters, and then the father died. Then it picks up the son and moves forward. So that's what we're going to see now. And remember before, we had one change to that, and that was in the time of Noah, we had three sons. Most of them were just one. Then we have three in the time of Noah. But we're going to see something similar to this today. And so we're going to look at the descendancy from Shem to Peleg. And Peleg is important. I'll tell you why in a minute. So 2 years after the flood, when Shem was 100 years old, he became the father of Arphaxad. Arphaxad, I thought you pronounce it. And after he became the father of Arphaxad, Shem lived 500 years, had other sons and daughters. Okay, that's the pattern that we see. Now he moves to Arphaxad. Now, the reason he only picks one here is because this is the promise line that comes from Shem, comes down to where Abram and Jacob and Isaac and, you know, all of the Jewish families in the world come from. So even though Shem may have had other sons and daughters, this is the son that gets highlighted because he's part of the promise line. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. You know, we see Canaan, but, you know, we see back in Noah's time, Shem was the middle son. You know, Japheth was the oldest, Shem, and then Ham. And so it's kind of, it's normally it's the first son, but it's not always the first son. So God has the promise line. And of course, when you get down to Jacob and Esau, it's the second son, not the first son. So
it would not be good for the Jewish people to look back and realize that they were descendants of Ham.
Probably not. They don't eat beans, is that what you're telling me? So ham and beans wouldn't go together?
Yeah.
I'm not going down that path. Yeah, so they're all descendants of Shem. So now he moves from Shem to Arphaxad, and he says, when Arphaxad lived 35 years, he became the father of Shelah. Now, the other thing to notice is the ages are declining. You know, some of them were 200 years old when they had their sons. Some of them are 100. Now we're getting down into the 35-year-olds. When Arphaxad had lived 35 years, he became the father of Shelah. After he became the father of Shelah, he lived another 403 years and had other sons and daughters. Again, but this is the only one that's important. Now, all these others fill the earth. All these others provide husbands and wives for all the sons and daughters that are out there. And then Shelah lives 30 years, and he becomes the father of Eber. We talked about Eber once before. Eber is the name where people think the term Hebrew came from, because in the Jewish language, in Hebrew, it sounds Eber sounds like Hebrew. And so that's where they think that kind of became Hebrew. I don't know whether that's true, but that's the common thinking of all the commentaries. So he became the father of Eber. Shelah lived 403 years and had other sons and daughters. Eber lived 34 years and became the father of Peleg. Now, anybody remember what Peleg means? We talked about this last week or the week before. This is a memory test. Peleg means division. And people theorize that in the time of Peleg is when this dispersion of languages came about and the people were divided. There's also some, if you read some of the geographical history books, this is a time they think when the world began to separate, you know, on the continents begin to move and all that. I can't tell you whether that's true or not, but I do believe that Peleg marks the time when the languages were confused and people begin to move out, and that's why he has that name. So all of this is the same genealogical pattern, and then when Peleg, that means division, he lived 30 years, he became the father of Reu, R-E-U, which means friend, which is, you know, I haven't done a deep dive on all these names, but some of them are pretty interesting. And so Peleg lived 209 years, had other sons and daughters. Reu lived 32 years, became the father of Reu and Seru. And the word Seru means intertwined, or, you know, tangled together. And maybe this is because at this particular time, you know, after people are separated, the availability of husbands and wives were probably narrowed, and a lot of people were becoming intertwined. Families were becoming intertwined. You go to Dawsonville. She's giving me the evil eye. If you go to Dawsonville and you go to a funeral, you never say anything bad about anybody, because everybody in there is kin to somebody back there, you know, some way back down the line. And my guess is this was the same way here. So I'll catch, you know what, for that later. So Serug lived 30 years and became the father of Nahor. Now, Nahor is used a couple times, and that means scorched or burnt or hot. Now, I don't know exactly. I can't tell you why that's the case. I don't have any way to relate what that means, but it is an interesting name. And you wonder, since children all were named for something that either happened to them or happened if the parents wanted to happen to them, or a circumstance of their birth, it is kind of interesting. And I suppose you could spend a lifetime trying to figure out all these things. And so after he became the father of Nahor, Serug lived 200 years, had other sons and daughters. Now we get to another important one I'm highlighting in red. When Nahor had lived 29 years, he became the father of Terah. Terah means patient breathing or patient breath. Not a doctor's patient's breath, but a calm breathing. Many people equate this to a spiritual thing, because the term for breath is ruach, which is same term for spirit or wind. So people equate some serious spiritual idea to Terah. And why is he important? So after he became the father of Terah, Nahor lived 119 years, had other sons and daughters. But Terah then, Terah becomes the father of Abraham. So I'll jump a slide ahead. I put this slide back in because I wanted to show you something. If you look at this slide, this is all of the sons who were in the ancestry and how long they lived. And we talked about this group up here, Noah, But we're now down here into the time of Terah, these three, Terah, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob down here. So all of these, notice the lines are getting much shorter here. You know, God's decree to make man's life shorter is taking place. So Terah is the father of Abram. Abram, who becomes Abraham later on, is the father of Isaac and Ishmael, who you know from the stories. Isaac is the father of Jacob and Esau, and Jacob becomes Israel and is the father of the 12 tribes of Israel. So you begin to see the narrowing now of the line of promise as we move through all these generations of genealogies. After Terah lived 70 years, he became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now, it's always been one son, except for Noah. Now we have three sons again. So we have a kind of a breaking point in this lineage, and it's important for these three sons. And you'll see that hopefully as we get in here a little bit more. So Abram means exalted father or shield. So he becomes the shield or protector of the family. And this is the account of Terah's family line. Terah became the father of Abram, which we know means shield. Nahor, which means hot and scorched. And Haran, which means mountaineer or mountain dweller or mountain traveler or mountain pilgrim. It's a term for somebody who wanders the mountains. Haran became the father of Lot. Now we know who Lot is, right? We certainly know who Lot's wife is. We don't know her name, but we know who she is. And the term Lot means to cover or to envelop, not envelope, but to envelop, to come around. While his father Terah was still alive, Haran died in Ur of the Chaldeans in the land of his birth. So now Terah has one son that dies. We don't see much of this in these genealogies, but this one dies while Terah is still alive in Ur of the Chaldees. Now that's the area, where Abram comes from. They're all born in that area. So he dies. Now how he died, I don't know. Maybe he was, out walking the mountain somewhere and fell off. I don't have any idea. Could have been, from anything. But he dies. And it says, Abram and Nahor both married. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, which means princess, by the way. And the name of Nahor's wife was called Milcah, which means queen or counselor. She was the daughter of Haran. So you can see here, they're first cousins, right? Their first cousin. Nahor marries his first cousin, Milcah. And that Milcah means to weave a cover, or excuse me, Ishcah means to weave a cover, or whatever that means. And Sarah was childless. We know this from the future stories we get in the other parts of the Bible, because she was not able to conceive. So we get the understanding here of what this is. Now, what's interesting is Terah is told by God to leave the area. And he does. Terah took his son Abram, his grandson Lot, son of Haran, his daughter-in-law Sarai, wife of his son Abram, and together they set out from Ur of the Chaldeans, to go to Canaan. So God had initiated a call to Canaan. Now Abraham was traveling with his father, his wife, his nephew, all of their servants, all of their animals. They were all leading kind of a troop of folks heading up out of Ur of the Chaldees up into what we would call Syria today. But when they got to Haran, which is a kind of a waypoint on the way, they stopped and they settled there. And I suspect, because time has passed, Terah's getting old and he doesn't go any longer. He just stays there and he dies there in Haran. So I think it's kind of interesting that all of this begins to happen. And we get into chapter 12. I think I've got one more slide. Let me see if I do. No, I don't. I've got a, let me go back to one of the maps because I thought I put it in here a second time. Okay, so this one will do. So right in this area is the area of Ur of the Chaldees. And then they left and they went up. They left and they went up into this area, which is modern-day Syria. And that's where they went, Iraq and Syria. And that's where they went on the way to Canaan. Remember, Canaan is down here. So they traveled up probably along the valley, and then they were going to come back down through the big valley into Jerusalem, into where the Canaanites lived. So I stopped there because chapter 12, we begin to take a look at the line of the call of Abram and where he goes and why he goes and does what he does. Any thoughts about this so far? I know it's probably been a little bit confusing, but I wanted to say at the end of chapter 10, we knew all the languages and all the cities and all the nations, but we didn't know anything about how they got where they did. And so we looked at a little prophecy to show they do come back in the time of Ezekiel in a prophecy. But also there's a lot of things happening underneath that begin to set the stage for the coming Messiah. I mean, we think about Jesus just being born, from Mary and Joseph, but Mary and Joseph both had very specific bloodlines to get to where they were, because Jesus was part of the promised line that came down through what we're watching now. Any questions, any thought, John? Right.
And that's the place they settled.
Right, that's the place they settled. I think the names are coincidence. I don't think, because Haran died down in Ur of the Chaldees. But there's Haran with one R and there's Haran with two R's. And I think the brother was two R's and the land was one R. Now, I don't know what the difference is, unless Haran was a fairly common name. One R is the difference. Yeah, thank you. Well, Abram didn't get the call yet. This is the call. His dad moved out on the way to Terah on the way, and they stopped at Haran. And then they stay there for a while, and then Abram gets a call from God to move on to Canaan. So the call came, and it got stopped, but Abram picked the call back up. We'll see that in chapter 12. Yeah. Right. Well, I think all of that really comes to this one world order is because, it's a control issue for a lot of people. They want to control everything. But B, it's a way that the people can solve the problems of the earth. And if we solve the problems of the earth by doing it together, we don't need God to do it. And I think that's part of the Achilles heel of this organization, the World Economic Forum or whatever you want to call them. They're trying to build another Tower of Babel, but they're trying to build it in the European area. So yeah, I think that's a real good analogy. Yeah, but they don't read the Bible. Most of them don't read the Bible. Wouldn't have any clue what God has said to do. John, you had another question. I don't know the answer to that. It could have been he just wanted to leave because his son died there and moved north, or it could have been a premonition about a call to Canaan, because the real call comes for Abram, and it comes in chapter 12. So I don't know. I think God tends to orchestrate us. You ever notice how God moves us to a certain place and then something happens? We don't know why we were at that place, but when we look back in our history, we see that God's hand has moved us there. Most of us, as we move around the country, wouldn't have picked up and chosen to move various places. But during that time, when we look back, we see the hand of God in it. So I think that's probably what it was here for Para, you know, and of course the God moved him there because it was halfway to Canaan. And it gave an opportunity for Abram to grow his you know, herds and tribes with Lot. Yeah.
Oh, Paul
and I haven't seen that website. I use the Hebrew dictionary online to get the translations of the names. Yeah. In the names. That would be interesting. I'd love to see that website. Okay, thank you. So we can have your own little study guide there to look it up instead of having to do it all like I do on the internet, just looking it up that way. Any other comments or questions? Okay, yeah. Well, that's an interesting question. Why are the Jews a small percentage of the world being persecuted by the world? I would just say that in the end times, the statement is made that the whole world will be against the Jews. And I think we're seeing that prophecy being fulfilled now. You know, people that have no reason to be hateful are hateful. And part of it, I think, is because they represent the chosen people of God, and therefore, if they're the chosen of God, they don't want anything to do with them. And they'd like to stamp them out, even though they may not know why. I think it's a Satan influence that drives them to do that. So, I mean, there's probably a few regional reasons, too, why they don't like Jews. You know, I'm sure the descendants of Esau don't like, you know, don't like the descendants of Jacob. But, you know, I think the bigger reason is because that's the way God said it would be, and that's the way it is.
Again, the big reason is in the end, the Lord's going to show people who's going to destroy.
That's for sure. He will do that. Every knee will bow.
Deliver all men, most of me.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, let's have a prayer and then we'll dismiss and you can get over to church maybe a little further than normal. Lord, we're just thankful for this chapter to look at. We're thankful that you have guided the hands of these early ancestors to guide them in the way you wanted them to go, guide their children, guide their travels, guide what they do. Lord, we're thankful not only that you did that, but we're also thankful that we can read about it and study it. Lord, I pray for our pastor as he comes. I pray for the sermon he has been given. I pray that it's an anointed time that we can speak your word. I also pray, Lord, that each of us who hears it will hear the particular part of it that we need to take into our own heart. Lord, I'm thankful for this class. I'm thankful for all of the love and prayer and support that we give each other. Lord, I just ask that you bless us all. Pray in Christ's name. Thank you all.
Yeah, very good lesson. I'm so glad you're doing Genesis.
Thank you.
Really important. And
thanks, everybody.
You know.
Thank you, Jim.
And I studied it. I learned.
Learned something about it?
Something new, yeah. Or maybe I've forgotten it. Relearned it.